Let's go. I see everyone in the chat saying, let's go, let's go. It is Wednesday. Welcome into Redacted. I'm Clayton Morris.
I'm Natalie Morris. Welcome to your May, you guys.
Oh, it's May,
today
yes.
Today's the first of day. It's May Day.
May Day. Happy May Day. Today's a good luck day for a lot of people. But maybe not for the U.S. government as we continue to expose them here on the show. And we're going to be covering that tonight because why are U.S. soldiers perhaps about to be sent right into the Gaza Strip? This is exactly what Secretary Lloyd Austin just got in a big debate with Matt Gaetz about. But why are we agitating to put American soldiers in that area in direct harm's way? Does it benefit the United States in any appreciable way? That's the question we're going to be asking tonight.
Plus, there is a free speech crisis on American universities, and now it has resulted in students getting arrested for protesting. Is this because of ideology, or is it because we have not taught this next generation how to have productive dialogue? We're going to talk about why universities have created this mess and now they have to sit in it. As my friend used to say, if you're happy in a pile of S, stay in that pile of S. That's what they've created of their own making.
Yeah, these free speech zones on universities, how'd that go for you? And your microaggressions and all of that crap. Also, we're going to talk about Canada tonight because Pierre Poilievre was just thrown out of the House of Commons last night anyway, because he called Justin Trudeau a radical and a wacko and an extremist. But wait a second, didn't Justin Trudeau say the exact same things on the floor of the House of Commons about the opposition? Why is there this hypocritical nature right now going with the
authority? Talking about free speech. Not in Canada.
You can say that, but you can't. I guess Canada, no. There's no free speech in Canada. We'll talk about that tonight. And we're also going to talk about the RSV vaccine, of course, just approved. The FDA, why are they approving something that they know has all sorts of adverse side effects? We'll talk about that on the show tonight. You know, I think there's like a theme in today's show, which is like kind of, let's like step back a little bit and don't be fooled by these globalists and their agendas. And from our Canada story tonight to our Israel story tonight to the Columbia, the college protest story tonight to the biopharmaceutical complex, like they want us to be like in a civil war. They want us to be just thinking about the granularity of these issues, the back and forth with all the tension on campus and all of these things, Israeli, Palestinians. But what's really going on here? I think tonight it's like a story about sort of the 30,000 foot level.
Well, yes. As I was researching my two pieces today, I'm doing the one on free speech and the one on the RSV. I was thinking to myself, we are in fact in the middle of an Enlightenment 2.0 because the RSV vaccine has a lot of questions that we are not supposed to ask. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm not sure how good or bad this is. We are not being given the chance to have informed consent. We are not being encouraged to ask the questions, but we're going to ask the questions. And so join us, you guys. This is the next enlightenment period.
I like that.
We're in it.
Yeah. Ask the questions. Question everything right now. When they want you to feel a certain way, like question that. Why exactly are they doing that? So we're going to get to that tonight. And let's talk about this. Let's start off with this then. Which is many Americans, by the way, mistakenly believe that the president of the United States is a man by the name of Joe Biden, right? I think most people probably think that, this guy here. But of course, that's not true. We all know that guy, the actual president of the United States, is a man by the name of Antony Blinken, which is this guy. This is the real president of the United States, regardless of the fake Secretary of State title that he holds. He's actually making America's foreign policy decisions, delivering those messages right to world leaders. Last week, flying to China, demanding that they stop supporting Russia, then to Ukraine to make sure that Zelensky knows, hey, more money is on its way. Don't you worry about a thing. We've got more money coming to you as part of our CIA-run war in Ukraine. And then there's, of course, his vice president is a man by the name of Alejandro Mayorkas. He's in charge of domestic U.S. policy. So see how this works. Blinken is in charge of the foreign policy. Mayorkas is in charge of domestic policy, working in lockstep, by the way, bringing 10,000 tens of thousands of illegal immigrants into the United States, displaced Palestinians into the United States out of the Gaza Strip. This, of course, was always the plan, which you'll see in a moment. But both of these guys report to a man, their boss, by the name of Benjamin Netanyahu. But he doesn't live in America, where maybe you live. He lives in a place called Israel. That's why President Blinken has been racking up so many frequent flyer miles flying to Israel over the past few months. He's going to his remote office on a regular basis, his WeWork location in Israel. Here he is. That's why last night, once again, Blinken arrived once again last night at his WeWork office in Israel to talk to his boss, Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, the last time Blinken stood before Netanyahu, he said, "I stand before you as a Jew." Those were his words. When Biden was set to pick Blinken as Secretary of State, of course, Israel was very happy about this. They loved this idea. In fact, the Jewish Journal said, quote, "Blinken, 58, has been one of Biden's closest policy advisors for over a decade and espouses the opposite of Trump's America First agenda."
So that means America last?
Yes. So we like him. This is why we stand behind Blinken, because he is really anti-America first, literally in the Jewish Journal. And echoed across.
So by that we can deduce he'll be putting us first?
No. He'll be putting
the Israeli readership.
I guess. I don't know. I mean, okay. It's not America he's putting first. Don't think that for a second. So Blinken is anti-America first. Got it. We got that. That's why they love him so much, by the way. As Colonel McGregor points out, Americans are beginning to figure out that they have no real representation in Washington. The two parties are quickly becoming irrelevant. The truth is, we have one party, the Uniparty.
So yes, that's clear to me increasingly every day.
Yeah, and I think as we get through the end of today's segment, again, in this segment that I'm talking about here, they really want to pit one against each other, right? But I want you to, again, go 30,000 foot level. Why are they doing this? Why is this all happening right now? Hey, Camel Toe Hunter, thanks for becoming a rebel. Welcome to the rebellion, Camel Toe Hunter. Thank you for... thank you for becoming a member of the Redacted Rebellion.
Hope you get that worked out.
Yeah, hope you get
comfortable.
Hopefully get your camel toe worked out. But thank you for subscribing to the channel. I really appreciate it, Camel Toe. So on the Blinken agenda, during this meeting, a few big points to further drive America into the ground. So you're meeting with Netanyahu. What are you going to be talking about? Clearly, first on the agenda is moving thousands of displaced Palestinians out of Gaza before they're killed in Rafah, to settlements designated by the United States and Israel. This has been part of the plan for a while, including free flights and free passage right into the United States. As CBS News has obtained the documents right from their friends at the CIA, they're sort of testing the waters. So the CIA gives CBS News their documents. Remember, they're very much, very, very close, the CIA and CBS. In fact, perhaps maybe the closest news organization to the CIA, but here they are. Here's the documents. Here's what's going to happen. CBS, you go on the nightly news and you tell America what's about to happen.
White House is considering welcoming some Palestinians from Gaza into the United States as refugees. This is according to internal federal documents obtained by CBS News. The Palestinians under consideration would include individuals with immediate family who are either U.S. citizens or permanent residents. Last year, the U.S. moved 60,000 refugees from around the world, but only 56 of them were Palestinian.
So we're going to really amp that number up. Only 56 of them. We're about to kick this shit into overdrive. 88 miles an hour. You're going to see some serious shit. According to the report, one proposal would use the United States Refugee Admissions Program. You just have to find the programs. Like, where's the money? Who's the facilitator? How can we use the NGOs to make all of this happen? So they're going to bring Palestinians into the United States as part of the refugee admissions program with U.S. ties who may have escaped into Egypt. Of course, that's been coordinated as well. We've also covered here the massive open-air concentration camp on the Egyptian side that's being built on the Egyptian side of Rafah. So when they're forced out of Rafah, if they're not killed, they'll be forced over into Egypt, or they'll be taken by the United States directly into the United States. That's what's about to happen here, that you cannot stay in Gaza any longer. You can't go home. So those who pass the eligibility requirements then will fly into the United States with refugee status, receiving housing assistance. We've already been told from the Biden administration they will be given basically a stipend to live in the United States. They will be given rent. And they'll have a path towards citizenship. So this plan doesn't happen just overnight. Of course, this has been many years in the making. Democrats support this plan 100%. Here's the alarm bell pulling Jamal Bowman. Says, yes, bring them into the United States.
Should the United States bring in people from Gaza?
Well, we are a land of immigrants, and we are a land of asylum seekers. Anyone escaping persecution and oppression and violence, the United States has always been an open home to those people. So whether they're coming from Palestine, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, Mexico, Haiti, they're coming here to contribute to our economy, which 99.9% of them are. We've always been a place to open our doors to immigrants coming here. So yeah, fully support that. And also fully support amnesty for the migrants who have been here for quite some time.
Yeah, so if you're here illegally, amnesty, and we're ready to bring you in from Palestine.
Okay, wait, a couple of things. Can we just put up a still, that video
still?
Again? Just put that video again, but don't play it.
Okay.
Are you able to do that? It's okay.
To the United States.
So first of all, he needs a bigger coat. That button's hanging on for dear life. Second of all, what he said about Palestinians coming here to contribute to their economy is a fundamental lack of understanding of what they want. They would like to live where they live, own that land as a nation state, and not be bombed. They're not like, oh, let me go and live in America and start a new life and contribute to their economy. No, they have a dream for a sovereign state of Palestine. So it's like that's stupid. That's a stupid thing to say.
Well, this is all part of the disruption plan, right? The United States goes in, disrupts those countries. He mentioned Guatemala, he mentioned Honduras, he mentions all of these areas that we knowingly funnel money and weapons into in order to destabilize those countries. We're actively funneling money and weapons into the very areas where we're driving people into the United States. These people don't want to be in the United States. They want to be in their home countries, but they are being driven out. So we always talk about the end of this, which is them coming across the border, but we don't talk about the destabilizing on the front end.
It's almost hilarious, these aspirational Palestinians who want to become a part of the American economy.
Right.
Their aspiration is for their homeland, for their own home, to live in safety.
Now, of course, Palestinians can't stay in their own homes in Gaza. We've already established that, like they've either been destroyed or you're not allowed to stay there any longer, of course. Overnight, Netanyahu announced that they will attack Rafah. That's the southern portion of Gaza, of course, where all the Palestinians are being held at this point. So they'll either be killed or they'll be resettled in the United States. Of course, the people there are starving, and aid trucks getting into this area with rice or other grains is nearly impossible. Israelis like to play a game where they attack these grain trucks like they did last night. It's so fun. They're laughing about it. They're laughing. These starving people can't eat. That fat guy doing the dumping looks like he hasn't skipped a meal in months. So it's okay for him. Let's just dump him on the street.
No, so bad he's got plumber crack.
Yeah, he's got that fat bastard. That fat bastard can throw people's food on the ground and then stomp on it and laugh and run away. And that's great. So glad you hopefully you can sleep at night. Meanwhile, many people are wondering why Jewish billionaire George Soros is funding some part of the protests. Why are they all using the same tents? When reporters ask some of them why they're there on college campuses, they don't know how to answer that question. Well, I don't know. I don't even know what's going on here. Okay. Why are you here? Stick a bunch of fake agitators inside of legitimate protests, and you have a perfect Soros concoction. He's been doing this for years. For years, he has. Occupy Wall Street, sound familiar? And anyway, it's hard to tell the real ones from the fake ones. These occupations, of course, are being coordinated by the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, the USCPR, journalist Gabriella Cuccia explains.
USCPR, U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Who knew? And it's funded by everyone's favorite guy, George Soros. His organization actually pays what they call fellows who start protests on campus. You gotta love capitalism, am I right? They like the socialism thing. They don't want to get, money's bad, America, the worst. But here we are, capitalism. This organization pays up to $7,800 to community-based fellows. And then for campus-based fellows, they get somewhere between $2,880 to $3,660. Very specific. Who wouldn't want to sign up for that type of money in Joe Biden's economy?
Right. With inflation running amok right now, this is exactly the type of, I'm going to make $7,000 and all I have to do is go and pretend that I care about something and I'm not from that school. Sure, I'll go do it. Why not? We know that the protesters who seized Hamilton Hall at Columbia were outside agitators. In fact, not students at Columbia, we now know. Approximately 300 were arrested at Columbia University overnight, the majority of whom are not students there. Where'd they come from? Good question. So why would a Democrat Jewish billionaire pay agitators to stir up some shit on college campuses? Well, what's interesting is George Soros is a huge fan of Antony Blinken. In fact, George Soros loved Blinken's father so much that he even named one of his buildings after him. Even his own archive is named after Antony Blinken's father. So he loves the guy. So true story, by the way. If Soros is on Biden's side, on Mayorkas's side, and Blinken's side, and Blinken is in Israel as we speak, what is really going on here? What do they want us to think about what's happening in the United States? There's a bigger game of chess being played here. Think deeply about this and then ask, why also are Israeli lobbying groups also funding counter-agitators? They didn't get much coverage of this, of course, but this is absolutely happening, which was well documented a few weeks ago by Gray Zone's Max Blumenthal. Yes, the same strategy as Soros, but on the other side. What's the purpose of funding both sides of this fight? I don't know. Three-dimensional chess. Max Blumenthal has a question, though. Will all of these mass protests prompt the DNC to hold the 2024 convention remotely, as Biden did with his entire 2020 campaign, walled off and a walled-off inauguration ceremony? Good question, right? It's a perfect cover. We can't have a DNC because of protests. So Biden is protected. We'll keep him in a cloister. You won't be able to ask him questions.
Right.
You won't get to see any of it. And it's an interesting point. I don't think that's the full picture and story of it. Who cares about a DNC at this point? But it's certainly food for thought, right? Meanwhile, turmoil continues to engulf college campuses. Natalie's going to talk more about it in a second. Coast to coast right now, from UCLA to Columbia to NYU. Late last night, police entered Columbia University's campus and removed pro-Palestinian demonstrators who had occupied the administration building roughly 20 hours before. Of course, again, as we pointed out, they were not Columbia students. So who are they? This happened under NYC Mayor Eric Adams, by the way. And he held a press conference about it, said he was really happy about it. He said, these outside agitators coming into our city, we won't stand for it. And he actually referenced Black Lives Matter movement, people coming in from outside and being involved in these things. George Soros funded as well. Seen here, Eric Adams is, by the way, just if you're unsure who Eric Adams is, he's the one on the left. The one on the right is his boss. So the NYPD last night then posted this after they successfully cleared out Hamilton Hall. They posted this on their social media to show their support of Israel.
No.
Yeah, this
is was last night.
Yeah, this is NYPD's website or a social media post, because, of course, NYPD has to share that, put that up there with it. So as Netanyahu explained, if you're curious about how all this happens and why are all of these government officials so in bed with Israel, like what the hell is going on here? Netanyahu explained it all back in the 1980s, back when he really wasn't a popular star, back before he became Blinken's boss and Mayorkas's boss. This is how they control the United States. He explained it back in the 1980s. Listen. Yeah, so we have very strong influence over the general support of the United States. We have Congress, we have the Senate. We basically are able to control the United States, he admitted. So after this, you know, if you're wondering why, after all these protests, why are we seeing all of this now? Why are we seeing this agitation, this focus in the United States on college campuses right now? All of the media coverage is about it. So when all of the corporate media is covering this, but they're ignoring what's happening thousands of miles away in Gaza, something's probably going on. And sure enough, it is, because all of this resettlement plan is happening while this is happening. This joint port project is now unfolding, which will enable the United States and Israel to steal all of that oil and natural gas just sitting off the coast of Gaza. So here you are looking at the foundation being built of our new port that will steal all of that oil and natural gas. Of course, all along, as we pointed out, guys, this is all about oil. This is all about money. This is all about natural gas. It's all about stealing resources. It's all about building beachfront condos. right there. Look at this beautiful brand new port being built. So Fiora Isabel writes, the journalist says, Israel and the U.S., the United States have begun construction on a port located 20 miles off of the $500 billion Gaza marine oil and gas fields where tens of thousands have been killed. Sabrina Singh, a Pentagon spokeswoman, told media the cost is $320 million and includes the transportation of equipment and pier sections from the U.S. to Gaza's coast, as well as the construction and aid delivery operations. So, yes, you American taxpayers are paying for a new port to be built right inside of Gaza. $320 million. Did you sign up for that? By the way, we now learned inside of that massive aid package to Ukraine and Israel last week that was passed by Congress, slipped in there, we now know, was a massive plan for resettlement in the United States. Millions of dollars to resettle Palestinians out of the Middle East into the United States. So yes,
and in true U.S. fashion, U.S. fashion, we're paying for this port. So our taxpayers are paying for this port so we can bring aid into the people that we have displaced to build this port.
Right. And so not even really bring aid to them, right? Really steal their oil, steal their natural gas. So yeah, we've already done there's not going to be much aid needed left because they won't be there anymore. They're going to be gone. As you can see, we've cleared the area. You know, there used to be homes here. There used to be buildings here. Those are being cleared out. And of course, a new port is being built with the United States and Israel in lockstep. So yes, we're building this, and it will station 1,000 American soldiers to protect the theft of oil that we're about to embark on. Can you believe this? So Congressman Matt Gaetz sees right through this BS and questioned Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin about this new pier project and U.S. soldiers being used as cannon fodder around the world when we should be focused here in the United States.
Ms. Lotkin just said there'll be about 1,000 U.S. service members operating a pier system off of Gaza. How many of them will have guns, Mr. Secretary?
Well, typically all of the deployed service members carry guns, and they have the ability to protect themselves if challenged.
So if someone from land in Gaza shoots at our service members who are on the $320 million pier that we're building, you're telling me our service members can shoot back?
They have the right to return fire to protect themselves. Now
I want to move to the likelihood that you think someone from land in Gaza might shoot at our service members on this pier. Do you think that's a likely scenario?
That's possible, yes.
This is a very telling moment, Mr. Secretary, because you've said something that's quite possible that could happen, right? Shots from Gaza on our service members, and then the response, our armed service members shooting live fire into Gaza. That is a possible outcome here so that we can become the port authority and run this pier. Right?
That's correct. You know, I expect that we will always have the ability to
counter ourselves. Don't you think boots on the ground? President Biden told the country that we weren't going to have boots on the ground in Gaza.
And we won't.
Okay, but you guys parse the distinction between, like, when Americans think boots on the ground, they think Americans in harm's way or engaged actively in a conflict. You guys seem to be sort of saying that boots on a pier connected to the ground, connected to service members shooting into Gaza, doesn't count as boots on the ground?
It does not.
I think you're going to find the American people have a different perspective on that. And if we're going to have people shooting into Gaza, we probably should have a vote on that pursuant to our war powers.
Oh, my God.
Okay. No.
So is this like the new... I see this new tactic of where we don't declare war. I mean, not that we declare war anyway, but we just move soldiers into an area. And then when people shoot at them, they're like, well, they shot at us first. So
exactly.
We had to return fire.
This is right. This is the plan.
But no,
and this
it
is
makes
why...
it literally a game of floor is lava. Like, I'm not touching the
right.
actual
like,
ground.
Or when our kids
I'm
are walking.
Floating on a pier.
Don't touch the crack.
Yeah.
Don't touch the crack.
If I can just somehow get on pogo sticks or something, doesn't count.
So 1,000 American soldiers there. And yeah, and we're going to be shooting live fire. And he admits openly that this is the case. Brick suit, I like this tweet. Austin would straight up outfit all American troops with Crocs, deploy them in the middle of Gaza, and then claim we don't have boots on the ground, just Crocs. Austin is just flat out lying with semantics. Ron Paul, my political hero, is not having any of this. He says, former presidential candidate Ron Paul, says sending 1,000 U.S. troops to build a pier in Gaza turns them into sitting ducks. And of course, this is exactly what the Biden administration wants. The Biden administration has openly talked about how it's only a matter of time before American soldiers are killed. So what is all of this about? Of course, it's all about power. It's all about oil, and it's about stealing these resources. Paul says the real problem is that we're funding this war. We're funding it. He says, forget about just the boots on the ground for a second. We're sending all of our money to fund this genocide and this war over there. And we're not taking care of America at all. Watch.
You know, they're talking about boots on the ground, and that is important. But it is sort of unnecessary to think that is the big problem. How about our money landing over there, the stuff we buy, the weapons we buy, the financing of all the violence over there? That is where the real problem is. So, yes, we don't have the soldiers with their boots on the ground. We're going to put them on a pier to make sure that we don't look like we're vacillating and not knowing what we're doing.
Yeah. So let us know your thoughts on this in the comments below. But, you know, Antony Blinken still in Israel. We're going to see where this goes with these college protests and where this new movement towards putting U.S. boots and adding our assistance for oil and gas to get those resources out of Gaza right now. So how many of you honestly think that Gaza will be rebuilt and Palestinians will live there and they'll be able to use their own oil and their own natural gas? Like, how many of you think that that's going to happen? In the comments, let me know. I'd love to hear if you think that's going to be
allowed. That they will live in peace and have sovereignty?
Yeah, if that will happen. Yeah. I'd be curious about that.
It feels like such a pipe dream.
Be curious.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, you could ask that question from now backwards of 20 years, you know, 20 years past, and the answer would still be the same from me. You know, it's...
Right. No, yeah, it seems so unlikely. 60 years, really, since the establishment of Israel.
I'll be curious, too, because the United States and Israel created Hamas, as they like to say. The United States and Israel combined, and, you know, they didn't have weapons until the United States gave them weapons, and, of course, Israel created them. Will we continue to support them in this way? It's the perfect, you know, we think about the agitators in the United States in these protests, mm-hmm. and then you think about Hamas as being funded by the United States and Israel and weaponized by the United States and Israel. Like, what kind of a big three-dimensional chess game are they playing here? So the horrors that Hamas carried out on October 7th, capturing civilians, capturing Israeli hostages, going to the, you know, music ceremony and grabbing hostages and horrific killing of civilians, which did happen. But who funded them? Who gave them weapons?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this big, think bigger about all of this. Like, what do they want to have the outcome be here? And why was there stand down orders given to Israeli soldiers on that day to sit back and wait to allow all of this to happen? Well, you're seeing the port being built. So start to think about where this money is flowing. And it's all about the money, resources, and oil right now that's coming. That's going to be sitting on billions of dollars in resources.
Yeah. Well, we have more news to get to. We're going to talk about the free speech crisis on campus and how this is an opportunity to do better, to talk to students about real free speech and productive dialogue. Universities are not trying to do that, but some of them are. There is hope in this Enlightenment 2.0 that I'm going to keep. Hopefully. I'm sticking with this. That's what we're doing here. That's why you came to Redacted. We are part of the Enlightenment 2.0. We're also going to talk about, I'm going to have to learn his name. Polivier.
No.
Polar bear.
Not polar bear. Polyev. Pierre Polyev.
That's what I just said.
Polar bear.
Polyev. Okay, I'm sorry.
Pierre Polar Bear.
For whatever reason, that doesn't want to come out of my mouth. So, him being thrown out of Harvard.
I know. How many guys?
Pierre Polar Bear.
Is there any? Here's a good question. I know she has trouble with that name. Are there any names that you guys, or names or words that you find incredibly difficult to say
mm-hmm.
or spell? Let me know in the chat. Like, is there a word that you've spent years trying to spell it and you simply can't do it? For me, it's the word, I think it's the word definitely. I always...
You can't spell it?
I was just going to say, that's mine too.
Really?
That's mine too, is definitely. Yeah, I spell it so badly every time, even like spell check on my text message doesn't understand what the hell I'm trying to say.
Right, me too. I'm like and now I just hit a bunch of letters. I'm like D-E-F, and hopefully it figures it out.
You have to remember that the word finite is in it. Like, put finite in the middle of it.
How do you spell finite? No, I'm just joking.
No, that, because
def, And okay, that helps. Yeah, that helps.
Definitely.
See? I married up.
See? Clearly. Does that help you, Philip? Nope.
I don't know. I sometimes put an A at the end of it, like an A-Y. I don't know.
A lot of people, Stephen Chuckery in the chat says, same. Yeah, definitely is hard. Someone just said Worcester. A lot of people are saying Worcester or Massachusetts. Yeah, Massachusetts, it's hard. Mm-hmm. Tennessee can be difficult.
Yeah.
I always remember the little like rhyme for M for Mississippi, so I never misspell Mississippi.
Right.
That was always easy for me. MISSISSIPPI. So okay. I got that one down as a kid.
But, and there's a Portuguese word called reutilizável, is reusable. And for whatever, I cannot like wrap my head around getting that word out in a sentence. So, okay. That was fun. We're going to talk about all of that stuff. Did I tell you what else? Oh, and RSV. We're also going to talk about the new RSV vaccine and just ask some questions. That's all we're here to do, is ask some questions. Look at the data and ask some questions. So would you take an RSV vaccine if you were in your third trimester of pregnancy, if you knew that it could put you into preterm birth, which is what studies are showing? So first, though, we'd like to tell you about our friends over at Fast Growing Trees, because did you know that they are the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the U.S.? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, shrubs, so much more. Whatever you're interested in, they have it for you, and they can teach you to take care of it as well, because if you think, oh, I don't have a green thumb, I can't keep plants alive, well, not only will they help you find what works for your house and your neighborhood and your region, they will also give you tips on caring for those things as well. So it's springtime, it's May showers, right? It's time to get those plants in the ground. If you would like to try them out, you can use the code redacted for 15% off. So visit them and see what they've got that might be beautiful in your yard. Go to fastgrowingtrees.com/redacted, because again, this spring they have the best deals, up to half off select plants and other deals. And again, listeners to our show get an additional 15% off on their first purchase when they use the code redacted at checkout. So go to fastgrowingtrees.com/redacted. Use that code redacted at checkout. Offer is valid only for a limited time. Terms and conditions apply. Once again, that's fastgrowingtrees.com/redacted.
Deborah Harris in our chat says she has a difficult time spelling diarrhea.
Yes, I do too.
Yeah, I do too.
I usually try to get
rhythm,
close enough.
Rhythm is another one that...
Rhythm. Rhythm and diarrhea. Yeah, that's tough.
Yep.
Yep.
Rhythm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Keep them up. I like this Worcester sauce.
Indubitably. I don't use that word a whole lot.
Worcester sauce. Yeah, that's a hard one. All right.
Okay. Well, universities brought this encampment drama upon themselves because they do not understand the difference between free speech and expression and illegal behavior. And they have not taught their student body the difference between these things. My take on this is that, yes, it's definitely about Israel and Palestine. And yes, there are saboteurs working inside of these protest movements in order to push their own agenda. But what I really want to focus on here is this liberal problem that liberal universities have created for themselves. The encampment drama that started at Columbia and spread across the country is in crisis of the school's own making, because they don't have clear guidelines and they do not support free speech, only sometimes when the ideology is not uncomfortable for them. That means we, our generation, have failed to teach this next generation productive discourse. Now, this was pro-Palestine protesters this week seizing control of Hamilton Hall and barricading themselves inside, which Clayton just talked about in the previous segment. A lot of them were not students, but provocateurs. But let's watch what happened anyway. We we can, you get the idea of what happened there. Now, obviously, this has nothing to do with free speech, occupying a campus building and blocking students from attending classes and vandalizing property. Is not a protected First Amendment right. It's illiberal and illegal, and it was, in fact, punished. Now students were arrested because of their occupation of this land. Now, you could tell in that video, even if some of them were not students, many of them were and were cheering on the occupation and destruction of this building. Now, how, though, are students supposed to know what they can get away with and what they can't when the universities have allowed students to scream and yell and have basically toddler fits about things they don't like, and they've gotten away with it for the last decade? Consider this scene from Stanford in March of 2023, when Stanford Law School invited Judge Kyle Duncan of the Fifth Circuit, he's a judge, to speak in a talk about COVID, guns, and Twitter, and watch how he is heckled. This is not even the worst of it, what happened to him in this speech, but let's watch anyway. Okay. So what happens then is that woman who's an administrator, what happens later, her name is Dean Steinbeck. He asked for her help and she proceeded to speak for 7 minutes and take up his time. And she later questioned whether or not his controversial topics was worth it because it was upsetting the students. Now, he knew that he was a controversial figure. So when he was invited to speak, he spoke on condition. He asked the university that if students disrupted the event, they would be given a warning and then removed. Stanford agreed to that, but that did not happen. Not only did they show up and disrupt just setting the room up, they peppered the room with flyers and they yelled at him that they hoped that his daughters got raped. That's what they literally yelled during the speech. So it wasn't just heckling, it was disrupting the learning environment, occupying a building, and then threatening him, saying these threatening things. Now, he did get an apology from Stanford Law School Dean Jenny Martinez, and Dean Steinbeck, this woman who we just showed you, she resigned because of this, because there were calls for her resignation because she was so disrespectful to him. But none of the protesters were punished because they were told that their feelings about the rulings that this judge had handed down from the bench were so important that they could disrupt the learning environment. So they were not taught any kind of productive discourse. Again, consider when gender-critical academic Kathleen Stock was invited to speak at the Oxford Union later. She had so many threats, so many students threatened to come, and they had bomb threats. They had all kinds of basically whiny baby students saying, we cannot even platform her. We cannot let her speak at all because she is a lesbian who contends that biological sex is real and very important, especially to lesbians, and they could not hear that. She was shouted down and threatened. The university was surrounded, so much so that she had to have bodyguards leading up to this talk, and before and after. In fact, trans person Riz Posnett glued herself to the floor in advance of this speech. I mean, if you ever want to see what a whiny baby looks like that's what a toddler does. That's not what a productive discourse looks like. But she was not punished. She was applauded when she was removed from the room. All this to say, why wouldn't these pro-Palestine protesters think that they could do this? Black Lives Matter protesters did this. Me Too protesters did this. Universities have allowed protests that they think are ideologically popular and then went and shut down speech that's not. So those who are in the popular camp often go to extremes, and they're allowed it. And so this isn't about Palestinians or Jews. It's about how our society has lost productive discourse. And the prisoners are in charge, as the saying goes. Is that the same?
The inmates are in charge of the asylum, right?
That's exactly what it is. The adults are not in charge, and they haven't been for over a decade. But I want to give you two examples of universities leading in a productive way, in my opinion. One is the University of Chicago. They published this letter saying, this is what we do about campus protests, that free expression is the core animating value of the University of Chicago. So it's critical that we be clear about how we think about encampments and how the actions we take in response will follow directly from our principles. They say that their general principle is to provide the greatest leeway possible for free expression, even expression of viewpoints that some find deeply offensive. And they are committed to it. They said, as an example, earlier in the year, some protesters got permission to put a Palestinian flag made by Tiny Flags with a sign that said, honor the martyrs. Take a look at this sign. Now, they allowed it even though they realized that some might find this offensive, specifically people who may be Jewish or pro-Israeli, but they said, this is our values and we have to allow it. And they asked permission, and this is within the purview of free speech. And in contrast to this, last November, students protested the war and some attempted to occupy what they call Rosenwald Hall. And they were removed after repeated warnings because disrupting the learning environment is not a part of free speech. Watch.
Justice is our demand.
Wars continue on college campuses, advocating for peace in the Middle East. Students coming together at the University of Chicago today for another rally, demanding a public meeting with the school president.
So when they broke into that building, that's when it stopped. But up until that point, it's allowed. And that is how you create productive discourse. Now, the reason the University of Chicago does this so well is because they have a mission statement that's over 40 years old. And for this very reason, this here is Harry Calvin from the University of Chicago Law School. In February of 1967, he was asked by the university president to prepare a statement on the university's role in political and social action. And the report that he prepared is about 3 pages. I linked to it in the newsletter this morning, and I think it's actually a beautiful piece of academic work because it has a full stop commitment to free speech and free thought, but it gives the university the right to intervene if the learning environment is being disruptive. And he honors the fact that the university is an important place to discuss discomfortable subjects. Take a look at this. I wanted to just read this together, if you don't mind. This is what he said. A university has a great and unique role to play in fostering the development of social and political values in a society, or at least it did in the 60s. The role is defined by the distinctive mission of the university, and it defined too by the distinctive characteristics of the university as a community. It is a role for the long term. The mission of the university is the discovery, improvement, and dissemination of knowledge. Its domain of inquiry and scrutiny includes all aspects and all values of society. A university faithful to its mission will provide enduring challenges to social values, policies, practices, and institutions. By design and by effect, it is the institution which creates discontent with the existing social arrangements and proposes new ones. In belief, a good university like Socrates will be upsetting. How many universities allow for this right now? How many institutions in the West allow for the fact that in order to have social progress, we must be offended and upset by certain things in order to be able to see them from all ways? I think that this is a beautiful guiding document, but he does say this about the university's neutrality, that it's not indifference. He says the neutrality of the university as an institution arises not from a lack of courage nor out of indifference and insensitivity. It arises out of respect for free inquiry and the obligation to cherish a diversity of viewpoints. I just wished we could have a renaissance to this commitment, to this document. But he does say, if there is disruption of the university's mission, which is to teach, then the university should get involved. So again, this is a crisis about a productive and uncomfortable dialogue and our inability to have one. But here are some silver linings. There is hope. The state of Kansas passed House Bill 2105, which will become law this summer. What this law means is that public colleges cannot require DEI statements or any kind of political litmus test in their hiring practices. Did you know that universities do this in increasing numbers in the last decade? What it is, like, take a look at this one. This is from, where is it? Vassar College. They say that each program hiring for tenure track and multi-year faculty positions requests that all candidates submit a diversity statement. Now, think about this. You're a math teacher and maybe a damn good math teacher, but you're a white guy and you don't have a ton of thoughts on different types of diversity. You just want to do some math. Why do you have to submit to political litmus tests just to be a teacher? And what does that do? Well, what it does in the great book, The Canceling of the American Mind, is that it weeds out conservative professors. It creates universities that are a cesspool of uniminded people. And it's created the lack of diversity of opinion. And in fact, in tests, people who write their diversity statements about diversity of opinion don't get hired. But people who write an essay about, oh, I want to call on the Black students more, I want to give more help to the Native Americans, I want to promote LGB issues, those are the people who get tenure track. And Kansas has now said that's not allowed. So these two are places that I think, or these places, Kansas and the University of Chicago, are places where there are silver linings that people are saying, no, these are our values. They're hard and we're going to do it. But we look to these liberal universities and we see them failing to do it. And then they're so surprised that they have not protected free speech and academic diversity. So let me know what you think of this. Is this, again, a silver lining? Is this something we will learn from collectively in universities? For me, as I'm going to have a freshman in high school next year, I would never choose these universities for him to apply to, these liberal universities that have no commitment to free speech. But let me know what you think.
A lot of people in the chat have different opinions tonight, of course. Someone said, someone said, why don't all these protesters go to the United Nations and protest? After all, the UN created Israel.
That's a point, but Tommy Connelly. I think they have an ideology that, hey, this is our time. This is our Vietnam War. It's time for us to stand up. And I see plenty of videos online where some of the students are like, I don't know what I'm here for. I think this, and they have ignorant opinions.
Right.
But who cares? They're allowed to. Do you think everyone who protested the Vietnam War, even though they were on the right side of history, understood the intricacies of the war? Clearly not. That's their right. It's your right to be stupid. It's your right to be ignorant, but it's also your right to exercise your voice or be somewhere where you think maybe you might agree.
Yeah.
And if we decide, oh, they're probably wrong, we can't even allow them to be wrong, then we're moving towards an authoritarian state.
Moving towards it. I think that ship may have already sailed.
Right.
There is no free speech in the United States anymore, it seems, anyway. Here's someone in the chat says, Lee Argent says, Vietnam War protests drew just as much controversy as this. Perhaps even more. If you think about the Kent State and the shootings there, of course. What else do we have? Yeah, let us know your thoughts on this in the comments below. Greg Gibson says Soros, Soros, Soros.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, a lot of different thoughts on this. But anyway, again, I want to remind all of us to think about the bigger picture in these protests right now. Like, why are we seeing this right now? Why is the mainstream media covering it so intently, and what are they not showing us? What's happening behind the scenes right now? So we're going to talk more about these, of course, I'm sure, in the coming days ahead, but we're going to also talk about Canada tonight. Why is Justin Trudeau's government really clamping down on free speech and moving towards authoritarianism and throwing out the opposition leader from the House of Commons, which is what they did yesterday? Pierre Poilievre, of course, was tossed after calling Justin Trudeau a wacko and an extremist, but didn't he call him those exact same things, using those words, as an extremist on the floor of the House of Commons? I guess double standard in Canada. We'll talk about that in a second. Plus the RSV vaccine. What did the FDA know about the RSV vaccine and still allowing it to move forward and hit store shelves? We'll tell you about that.
For pregnant women. That's the one we're going to talk about.
That's right.
Yes, we're going to do that. But first.
But first.
This one's on you.
All right. Well, I was getting there. Let's tell you about our friends at Hillsdale College, because I got to tell you, if you want to take a free course right now, I think you really got to check out the American Citizenship and Its Decline course. You can take it for free at Hillsdale College. It's easy and free to get started and take amazing courses. I'm telling you, this citizenship course is eye-opening. It's predicated around the idea that when we have these sort of woke changes in the United States, it's rooted in the fact that we simply don't understand our Constitution, the meaning and the history of our Constitution. What makes this country so great? Why do we have certain things in our history that are important to understand? He even talks about, you know, you should understand who Harriet Tubman is. You should know who Andrew Jackson is. You should understand the implications of all of these things. You should understand how Americans fought and died in, you know, at the Battle of Shiloh. Like, what happened at the Battle of Shiloh? What happened at Gettysburg? And understanding what it means to be an American. If you don't have citizenship, as this course really lays out, if you don't understand citizenship and you don't understand the importance of it, then you don't have a country. You can get more than 40 free online courses at hillsdale.edu/redacted. It's so easy to sign up right now. You can learn about the works of C.S. Lewis, the stories of the Book of Genesis, the meaning of the U.S. Constitution, the rise and fall of the Roman Republic. And you may see a lot of allusions to the fall of the Roman Republic to what we're currently seeing in the United States. Or the history of the ancient Christian church with Hillsdale College online courses, all available for free. That's right, free. Go to hillsdale.edu/redacted right now to try it for free. hillsdale.edu/redacted. Well, it was a quiet week in Canada, and then suddenly all hell broke loose in the House of Commons, where you had the opposition leader, Pierre Poilievre, standing up to make remarks about the Justin Trudeau government when he let a few things fly that didn't go over so well and was then kicked out of the House of Commons. Watch this unbelievable back and forth.
When will we put an end to this wacko policy by this wacko prime minister?
No, no, no. That is not... There are a couple of things which are going on here today which is not acceptable. And I ask all members, please, to keep themselves, to control themselves. I'm going to ask two things. One, I'm going to ask the Honourable Leader of the Opposition to withdraw that term, which is not considered parliamentary.
Mr. Speaker, I replace wacko with extremist. He is an extremist.
The Honourable Member to please... I'd like to ask the Leader of the Opposition once again to just withdraw that comment, please. And I'll invite the Honourable Member. I'm going to ask the Honourable Leader of the Opposition to please withdraw that comment and simply withdraw that comment.
I'll replace it with radical fascist policy.
I am not asking to replace. I'm asking the Honourable Member to just simply withdraw.
Mr. Speaker, I replace the word wacko with extremist.
One last time. To please withdraw that comment and simply withdraw that comment.
I simply withdraw and replace with the aforementioned adjective.
Mr. Poilievre, I have to name you for disregarding the authority of the chair. Pursuant to the authority granted to me by Standing Order 11, I order you to withdraw from the House and from any participation by video conference for the remainder of this day's sitting.
So this looked like an unprecedented moment in the House of Commons. Let's bring in David Craden, journalist from Craden's Right up in Ottawa, Canada. David, I know you were watching this like crazy unfold yesterday on Twitter. Was this an unprecedented moment? What did you make of it just at a high level? And then we'll get into the details here.
It's not unprecedented. I'm trying to determine right now if this has ever happened before, even in terms of removing the leader of the official opposition from question period. It hasn't happened in my lifetime, and a lot of other political observers are saying the same thing, that this is unprecedented, at least in the modern age. And it really smacks of the totalitarian sentiment of Justin Trudeau. And this speaker is clearly in the pocket of Justin Trudeau. This was the most partisan decision I have seen him make yet, from a speaker who has made plenty of partisan remarks since assuming this job and this title. And it's interesting that Tom Mulcair, the former leader of the Federal and New Democratic Party, was on the air yesterday saying this speaker must go. He must resign, because he said, in my lifetime of politics, I've never seen a speaker act like this. And this is not a conservative talking. This is a former leader of the New Democratic Party. I am absolutely shocked that this occurred. Not just that Polyev was dismissed from question period unceremoniously, but that he was dismissed for using words that most people would say really weren't that bad. Wacko. He called Justin Trudeau a wacko, right, an extremist, and eventually even downscaled that to radical. The speaker would have none of it. Polyev had to completely retract the statement, completely pretend he had never said it. And Polyev, I have to say, I applaud him for this. He did not succumb to this pressure. He was kicked out, and most of his caucus left with him, because this really is an outrage. This is an outrage to democracy, because do we have an official opposition anymore in Canada when the speaker can do this? Clearly, he was acting on Justin Trudeau's advice. And why do I know that? Because the speaker had right by his side the standing order relevant to his action. How convenient. He reaches for the standing order and says, standing order number 11 says, I can do this to you. Like he was prepared to do this, like he was ready for this, like whatever Polyev said was going to lead to this conclusion. I think there's a setup here. I think this is corrupt. This is disgusting.
Well, also the hypocrisy of it spoke to me, too, because I've heard Justin Trudeau on the floor of the House of Commons and then in front of television cameras. I mean, not obviously inside of Parliament, but outside, calling Polyev an extremist. I've heard him use those exact same words, but I don't hear any complaints from the speaker about Trudeau's comments on the floor of the House.
There were no complaints. In fact, Trudeau yesterday used those same language. He called Pierre Polyev an extremist who is courting the support of far-right white supremacists, which, of course, is all nonsense, because right, Trudeau's referring to some chat group on the internet called Diagalon, which nobody even knows exists. And all it is a bunch of guys who get together in the weekend and say absurd things. And Trudeau's accusing him of being part and parcel with this, even though this group threatened his wife, threatened Polyev's wife at one point. And Polyev has already denounced them as a bunch of yahoos. So this argument from Trudeau is specious, but Trudeau is the one who calls his opponents racist, misogynist, sometimes even Nazis. Now, how does he get away with this? Why was he not reprimanded by the speaker yesterday for using the same language that Polyev used against him? This is not just a double standard. This is obscenely corrupt. And I think a lot of Canadians, not just conservatives supporting Canadians, but Canadians who still think a democracy is not just about having an election every 4 years. It's about having a viable opposition party in the House of Commons and about having free speech. We're rapidly losing our free speech in Canada. And apparently we're losing the official opposition party because the speaker is ruling in favor consistently with Justin Trudeau.
What do you think is going to happen to Polyev? Any major fallout from this? Fine? Some sort of other issue where he won't be able to come back for a while? Or what's the fallout here going to be?
Well, he'll be back again today in question period, unless he's out of the city for some reason. And I can't foresee any fine coming, because the speaker is already looking very bad over this. If he exacerbates this punishment by fining him, it's just going to look worse. What's going to happen to Poilievre? I think he's going to increase his lead in the polls. He's 20% above Justin Trudeau right now. And he's on his way to forming the largest majority government in Canadian history, if things remain the same. I think this is going to push him up even higher in the polls, because Canadians are fed up with a bully of a speaker and a bully of a prime minister who thinks they can elbow their way through democratic tradition and system in this country of Canada. We expect a little better than this. We expect a whole lot better than this from a speaker. And the British parliamentary system is supposed to be nonpartisan. It's not like the House Speaker in the United States, where it's clearly a partisan position. The House Speaker in Canada, in Great Britain, Australia, Commonwealth countries, is supposed to be above politics, is supposed to be nonpartisan, and is supposed to put the business of the House of Commons above all other things, including party politics that he or she might belong to.
Well, we'll watch this unfolding up there in the drama in Canada. David Creighton, keeping his eye on the pulse of it all. Thank you so much, as always, David. Great to see you.
Well, thank you, Clayton.
Thank you, David.
Someone, that's wild.
I know, it's crazy. I mean, the fact that he has like the paper there and he's like, you're speaking right now? I just happen to have this special order right here.
This is my opportunity to use it.
Well, special order number 11. Yes, this means you're kicked out.
You know he's not gonna put that back in his desk. It's just gonna stay up there. I mean, this is now what they do with opposition? It's just like anytime anybody speaks out and they don't like it, just boot them.
Yeah.
That's the new plan, the new way.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, you're out of here, polar bear.
Well, thank you guys all for subscribing to this channel. We stand for truth. We stand for free speech on this channel. We are anti-war. So if you are pro-war, then probably this is not the place for you. If you are in favor of totalitarianism, you are in favor of the government lying to you about vaccines, then this is probably not the place for you. Because coming up, we're going to talk about how the FDA knew something very dastardly about the RSV vaccine and decided to keep it from you, keep it from pregnant women. And it is incredibly troubling, but this is part and parcel with the biopharmaceutical complex. We'll talk about that in a minute. But first,
we want to tell you about our show sponsor, which is Provia, because, of course, premature hair thinning and hair loss is a problem for a lot of people these days. You know, stress, diet, genetics, chemtrails, who knows? All of it could be exacerbating the problem, but you can help fight it with Provia. It's a real solution that delivers on its problems without the harsh side effects and unwanted chemicals, and there's no need for a prescription. Provia uses a safe, natural ingredient called Procapil to effectively target the three main causes of premature hair loss and thinning, supporting healthy scalp circulation, the delivery of nourishing nutrients, and healthy hair follicle anchoring to your scalp. So Provia guarantees more hair on your head than in the shower or on your comb. It's effective for men and women of any age and safe on colored, treated, or styled hair. It's that easy. Plus, now new customers can save over 50% plus free shipping on Provia's introductory package. You can find it at proviahair.com/redacted. Each package includes a full 60-day supply of Provia serum for daily use, plus the Provia Super Concentrate for faster, more noticeable results. And every order includes your choice of a free gift right now at checkout. Provia works or your money back, 100% guaranteed. So don't wait. Order now. Get your free shipping at proviahair.com/redacted. One more time, that's proviahair.com/redacted.
Over on Rumble, some great chats tonight. Let's see, Deschamps APQ says, damn, I wish I had a better option than these unheard chats. I wonder if, that's a good question. I was thinking about that the other day. Is there something we could do on the show to allow maybe, I don't know, some like voicemails or phone calls or something like that? We'll have to think about that as we build out the new studio and everything. Like,
what do you mean by unheard chats? Like that you think we don't see them?
I'm not sure. I'm just curious, je chomps, what you mean by that. It's interesting. I don't know. Maybe there's a way we could do something like that by having phone calls, something like that.
Most things are possible.
Most things are
possible. Figure it out.
Yeah. And someone else said something about Polyev. Who else was this? Someone said, oh, yeah. Reichsel says, Polyev is not, quote, our guy. Pierre is controlled opposition. He's on board with a lot of what the liberals are doing. Maybe you could be specific on that, because from what I've heard, it doesn't seem like he's on board with much of their totalitarianism up there in Canada. But I'm sure, you know, look, there's a lot of feelings about that with these different politicians. So.
Sure. All right. Well, the new Pfizer RSV vaccine for pregnant women has shown a high rate of preterm births. This should not be a surprise because that was in their clinical trials, but we are seeing in real world observation more than they reported in their clinical trials. But even though they did see in their clinical trials that this RSV vaccine for pregnant women did have a high rate of preterm births, why did the FDA approve it anyway? Well, who knows? I'm beginning to suspect that the FDA doesn't have human health in mind. Maybe they have Pfizer's financial health in mind. I don't know. So here's the recent study. They are studying the VAERS system, that's Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. This is a reporting system that if someone has a bad reaction to a vaccine, they then report it and it's tracked. But not really. So we're going to talk about that in a second. Now, this is what this study did was take VAERS data for women who took the vaccine in their third trimester from last September until February of this year. And it shows a very high rate of adverse reactions overall and a high rate of vaccines that induce preterm birth. And also, I'm going to show you these closer, but I just want to show you them together. Here are all the adverse events that were listed. I know you can't see this really well, and I also did link you to the study in the newsletter this morning, so I hope you're subscribed to the newsletter so you can get all this data yourself. But it does show that there were at least 77 VAERS reports, 27 of them were preterm births. But you see here, we have at least one fetal death, which is interesting. We're going to talk about this fetal death. This means that the baby died after this mother was vaccinated. We're going to talk about that because GlaxoSmithKline stopped their vaccine trials when they got neonatal deaths. So now we've got one in Pfizer, but it's still going forward. No one's worried about this, by the way. The paper was published. It shows that these bad things are happening to a high rate of pregnant women when they get this vaccine. And that's it. Like, it's not a government that's raising the alarm bell. It's just a study. Now, I think we should take this all with a grain of salt because VAERS data is typically very low and unrepresented. So you have to think that most people who have bad reactions to vaccines do not report that. And the numbers are usually artificially low by design. Now, this is from the book that I've recommended several times, Turtles All the Way Down, that talks about exactly why, and it's a scan because I have a real book. I'm sorry, I couldn't get you a screenshot. I don't know if you can see my sloppy handwriting in purple in the last paragraph, but this talks about why VAERS data is so unreliable and low. It's because they only take data from three sources: vaccine manufacturers, healthcare professionals, and the general public. But only the manufacturers are required by law to report vaccine adverse events. Doctors are not. Now, why would that be? Patients and healthcare workers, most of the time, they don't know where to send those reports. Most patients don't. For instance, parents don't know, like, oh, I should report that to somewhere. They're not given, like, when your kid gets a shot, you're not given a pamphlet and saying, oh, if something happens, call this. They're not educated about that at all. Contrast that to the law that requires doctors to report infectious diseases to the CDC. Why does the government want to know by requirement about infectious diseases, but they don't want to know about vaccine adverse reactions? That's weird, right? So this study of the VAERS reporting system, again, we're going to call these 77 reports very low, but we're going to look at them because it's all we've got. And again, more than half of them were serious enough to require the mother to be hospitalized within a day of the vaccination. Take a look at this chart. And at least 12% of these reported preterm birth or other events that led to preterm birth, which is not good for the baby. The longer they stay in there, the better. And then it led to C-sections because the mother was not able to dilate. It was too early. And so they don't get the full benefit of a vaginal birth, which is better for the baby. And most mothers want to at least try to get there. So you have to ask, are they given informed consent when they get this vaccine about what this may do to their baby's long-term health and their pregnancy? Now, Pfizer publicized most of this data in their clinical trials in the summer of 2023. Take a look at this Yahoo News report in May of 2023. About how this vaccine was being tested on pregnant women, but the safety markers were not great, so they weren't ready.
Later in the third trimester is when it seemed to have the best efficacy, as well as strongest protection up to 30 days versus after that. Now, Pfizer is competing with GlaxoSmithKline for RSV vaccines. We did note specifically the that GSK actually dropped out or paused their phase 3 because of certain safety signals, which you can see, of course, indicated in those votes there, specifically on preterm births. Pfizer noted 5.6% in their vaccine group versus 4.7 placebo. GlaxoSmithKline noted 6.8% in their vaccine group versus 4.9 in placebo. So the placebo numbers are pretty close. They also do have some similar indications. One major difference is that GlaxoSmithKline's group also had neonatal deaths reported. So that was a significant safety signal as well. And that's what started that pause. So,
okay, but she goes on to sort of root, like, hopefully we'll get there, right? Because we want a vaccine to tell you about that's awesome. She seems very conflicted in even giving you these numbers at all because the news media doesn't like to tell you about adverse events. But nothing changed. Those numbers remained in all the trials we were given, and the FDA said, okay, acceptable risk. Although now we're not seeing that it's a 5.9% or in the fives at all. It's of the adverse events, almost half of them are having preterm births. Now, what she said there was correct, that GlaxoSmithKline paused their trials because they had neonatal deaths and Pfizer didn't, but now they do with this new VAERS reporting. Take a look at this study showing at least one fetal death.
Again, we should remind people the VAERS reporting is a fraction of the actual cases, right? It is intense amount of paperwork. It is incredibly inaccurate because it only represents a snapshot, a tiny fraction of all of these cases.
Absolutely. So now that we do have at least one reported death, anyone want to do anything about that? Bueller?
Of course not.
Anybody? Yesterday, we reported that the AstraZeneca COVID vaccine, which the UK government knew was causing severe harm in March of 2021, was not pulled from the rollout until May of 2021, and people died in the interim getting this vaccine that they knew was problematic. So maybe we want to learn from that mistake and move a little bit faster if there are any deaths reported and these adverse events. These are, again, I'm not saying it's not worth it. I'm saying, why is nobody asking the questions? These are the questions. And another relevant question is that, is this vaccine preventing babies from contracting and dying from RSV? So is it worth it? That's sort of what we should ask collectively. Is one neonatal death worth the fact that maybe 10 babies will not die from RSV? Well, the death rate for RSV is low, even though RSV is more dangerous for small babies and elderly people. It still has a low death rate for healthy babies. And we're not given this data. What we are given is the first round of clinical trials that showed that RSV vaccination of pregnant mothers did reduce hospitalizations, but they did not even assess whether it reduced infant death from RSV. In fact, they said so. This is from the clinical trials showing no infant deaths were assessed by the investigator as related to maternal vaccinations. So they just don't tell us. So how many babies died in order to prevent other babies from being hospitalized? We can sort of surmise now that we have one neonatal death to maybe prevent around 21 hospitalizations. That's what the vaccine clinical trials showed. But we're not even really sure about that. And we can't make many choices about it because the last rounds of clinical trials are not yet published, which is something I see increasingly every time we look at these vaccines. We just don't get the clinical trials before the FDA approves them. And most of the time in the FDA's press statement, they're like, they use the words acceptable, that we observed acceptable safety standards or whatever. So pregnant mothers are not given the full picture. Do they take this vaccine and risk a preterm delivery and possible neonatal death to prevent what we only know may prevent hospitalization, but not a bad outcome, not death? And I know that RSV is very serious for small babies. In fact, I had a small baby that had RSV. Here's my daughter, Ava, when she was 6 months old. And she's going to be 12 next week.
Little baldy.
Yes, she was super bald. And so, you know, would I have risked a preterm birth to save ourselves what was not a fun experience, taking my baby to stay in the hospital for 3 days on Christmas? I don't think I would have, because that outcome has a higher rate of survivability. Well, I'm not saying the vaccine doesn't have a high rate of survivability, but taking a chance like that, you know, you're supposed to be given these numbers when you take, when you're offered this vaccine. I wager most pregnant women are not given this. And so I am. I'm giving you the numbers. We're asking those questions. You let me know if you think that these are acceptable risks. And why is no one asking the FDA, if there's a fetal death, why don't we pull this? I'm just asking. I'm just curious. Those are the questions that you ask in an Enlightenment 2.0 era.
That's right. Let us know in the comments below what you think about all of this and more on tonight's show. Hey, we should mention we do have a daily newsletter. We'd love for you to subscribe to it. It's totally free. A great way to stay connected to our show, because these big tech censors are out there and they are watching very closely what happens when we cover certain stories. They don't like it. We're heading into an election year. It's going to become increasingly important for us to stay connected with you, because they love to block us, ban us, and hide us. Google has labeled us as dangerous, so I don't know why that is. They won't tell us why, but they have. If you subscribe to the newsletter, go to redacted.inc, just put in your email address, and you will receive a welcome email. But it might wind up in your dangerous folder if you're a Gmail subscriber. I guess they even, do they even have a dangerous folder? But it'll have like a little warning.
I don't know.
A number of our viewers said when they've subscribed to the newsletter, they get a little warning at the top of an email that says, we've like labeled this as dangerous. That's really shocking. We're dangerous because we cover the news. Anyway, just subscribe. Then you have to click confirm. And then tomorrow morning at about 7:30 a.m. Eastern time, you will receive the newsletter first thing in the morning. So,
and again, I should point out that we try really hard to make sure you have links to, say, court reportings, clinical trials, academic reports, so that you have it yourself.
Well, what she means by that in the newsletter, like if we're covering a House bill.
Yeah, this RSV clinical trial, I link you not to a CNN story about it. Not that they would cover anything like this, but I'll link you to the original academic study so that you can read it for yourself. The bad part about that is I assume you've seen it, so I bring ugly screenshots to the show.
Right.
And I'm like, I know you can't read that, but because I know that you have a link to it in your email, and it's a free resource that we hope that you use, because increasingly when you're reading the news leads you to, most mainstream media news leads you to an opinion or leads you to some conclusions that are big leaps, and they don't link you to any original sources so that you can verify that, but we want to.
That's right. All right, guys. So thank you guys for joining us here on this Wednesday. We'll be back here tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern time. So please subscribe to the channel if you're not already subscribed, like Camel Toe Hunter did earlier in the show. If you watched the beginning of the show, Camel Toe Hunter was one of our new subscribers.
Hope you're still here.
If you do subscribe, your name will pop up here on the big screen. And yes, right at the beginning of the show, Camel Toe Hunter subscribed to the show. That made my day, by the way. That made me laugh. So I appreciate that. Have a great night, everyone. We'll see you back here tomorrow.